Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next, where we sit with leaders that are shaping culture, healing, and the future here in Western New York. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and I'm honored to have a conversation today with Chantel Campbell. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
A lot of people already probably know your name already and who you are, but we're going to get into that okay. in a second for those who don't. But a leader at the Best Self Behavioral Health and feature panelist this year at the Sankofa Conference, which is the first annual conference.
Yes, I'm so excited.
I'm so excited, too. February 28th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Buffalo Academy for Visual and Performing Arts. Yes. Welcome to What's Next.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So how's it been coming? This has been a kind of whirlwind of going into all the different things that are happening in our community, just not yeah. locally, but nationally as well. So mental health has been a huge you know, topic for everyone.
Yeah, for sure. Mental health has been a topic both you know, on the funding side and the service delivery side, and then how we are all, you know, feeling mental health and feeling the impacts on our own mental health with everything that's happening
for sure.
globally.
For listeners who may not know, what is Best Self Behavioral Health and what's your role there?
Yeah, Best Self Behavioral Health. We are a certified community-based behavioral health center. And so we provide behavioral health counseling, substance use disorder counseling. We also have social emotional programs for young folks. We also house our child advocacy center, where kiddos who have been victims of any type of abuse can come and receive treatment in a one-stop shop. In my function as Chief Community Impact Officer, I do a few different things. I support our central intake team. I support our advocacy work, government relations. I also support our Black Mental Health Response Team, which was an initiative that started after 514, where we provide non-traditional wellness and mental health support to the community on the East Side. And I also support our after-school programs and community engagement.
Yes, and you've been in this game for a long time. So you know a lot about equity and diversity and what does that look like and all the social determinants of health. What drew you personally to mental health work in our community?
It's a little layered. I don't know that I necessarily sought out going into the mental health space. Initially in undergrad, I was a management and marketing major and I thought I was going to do fashion work. And I took this trip to West Africa that changed my life. And I decided to change my major and ended up going in a more community focused area. Kind of at the same time, by way of internships and part-time jobs during undergrad, I slowly found my way into health and human services. And then right out of undergrad, I worked for the Office of Mental Health doing some case management work, working with folks with serious and persistent mental illness. And so that was kind of the groundwork for me. And it really exposed me to all of the landscape of services and mental health in Western New York. And that was kind of the beginning.
That got you on the roll. You haven't turned back yet.
Haven't turned back. You know, I've had some detours here and there, but I always find my way back to this.
And community's always been at the center.
Always at the center.
It.
Always not just community, but underrepresented groups specifically mm-hmm. has always been the core of my work.
For sure. And I know that just from knowing you.
Yes.
that is very true. From your perspective at Best Self, what's the most pressing mental health needs that you're seeing in our Black families right now in our community?
Some of the pressing mental health needs. I don't know that the needs are always necessarily mental health needs specific, but certainly, as we were talking about before we got started, all of the social determinants of health that really impact our health outcomes, both mental health and physical health. People are really feeling it by way of housing, transportation, by way of workforce needs. Those are the things that are our drivers of our health outcomes. Certainly being around violence frequently, and even on the national landscape, the harms that are being done to Black and brown folks, we're experiencing collective trauma that we all have to heal from.
This SANCOFA conference is interesting because it's taking on all these very different Black perspectives. So the panelists, you know, will share widely with everyone. They're people from all different areas.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that Black health, that Black mental health was something that was a focus, because it's sometimes something that we tend to forget in the Black community, because other things seem to be, you know, kind of a little bit more at the forefront, especially when they're talking about, you know, financial things, or when they're talking about medical treatments and things like that. So why do you think that this is important, that at this conference, mental health is a major topic?
I think mental health is a major topic because I think it gives us the opportunity to discuss it from a different lens. You know, I think a lot of times when people think about mental health, they think about just going to sit on somebody's couch. Which is good, you know,
right. talk therapy is good. Yeah.
Talk therapy is good. But one of the things that we've been able to unpack and introduce to the community by way of the Black Mental Health Response Team is that mental health is building relationships and sitting in community with each other. Mental health is moving our bodies through dance. You know, we know that's your lane. That is mental health. Yeah. You know, mental health might be through painting or through drumming or through writing a song. And so I think it gives us an opportunity to really explore how we can approach mental health differently, and how we can all heal together in community.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that I know that is talked a lot about with this conference is the collective and the community. What do you think that our community needs in order to have more of a collective understanding of the importance of mental health? Because there's still very much a stigma in Black communities about mental health, even acknowledging that it's a thing, right? You know, some Black families like, oh, you know, they just a little off.
Or
they,
right,
you know,
right.
You know, we've lived with it in our communities in very, you know, it seems like simplified ways.
Right. You know, I think in terms of the collective understanding, I think it's an opportunity for us to really, you know, we've said stigma, but ultimately a lot of that is rooted in shame. From my perspective, you know, shame comes by way of some supremacist ideologies that we have been oppressed by often. And so I think it's an opportunity for us to just learn what it means to seek after mental health treatment, learns what it means to have good mental health and mental health care, and to have practices every day that are, you know, outside of just sitting on somebody's couch, but what it means to identify when we are not unwell and that it's okay to not be okay. I think if we start there to know that, you know, it's okay to not, and to know when you're not okay.
Right.
And so just to start to have those conversations, that is nothing to be ashamed of.
Because it shows up in real life. And I think that's one thing that we don't always acknowledge when we're in relationship to people, that, you know, there's that shame or that vulnerability of not feeling comfortable to say, hey, I'm not really doing that well today. We're kind of trained to be like, oh, no, I'm fine. Like, don't, you know, I got this. We're good. What are some ways that you think that we could collectively work as a community to kind of bring that shame? You know, it may not necessarily go away, because that's something really difficult to do, but we can kind of start to minimize that a little bit.
I think it starts with each one of us, right? Individually, before we can get to the collective, I think it starts with each one of us taking a responsibility to have those conversations, to show up with vulnerability in our individual interactions. And that kind of spreads out, right? To start to acknowledge when we're not okay, to watch our language, and to start to just create safe space for each other in those one-on-one connections.
It's so interesting because I think a lot of times, you know, talked about the talk therapy. We don't know sports support can look many different ways. And so you mentioned some a little bit earlier, but can you dig in a little bit more into the work that Best Self is doing so that it doesn't look like it's the traditional just talk therapy, right? You know, we talked about substance abuse. There's a variety of ways in which mental health show up that isn't necessarily the back and forth. So what are some of those services?
One of the things that I think people can really relate to, and I'm really proud of the work that we're doing in the peer space, the peer recovery mm-hmm. space. We have adult peer advocates, we have family peer advocates, and youth peer advocates. And to give some framework for folks who don't know what that is, a peer advocate is a licensed and trained professional who has lived experience either through mental health treatment or substance use or substance recovery. And so these are folks who have been through it, who can walk the walk with you, who can help navigate systems to just sit with you. So it doesn't feel like, you know, you're going to through this clinician, but it's somebody who can really identify with the struggles that someone might have. And so that is mental health treatment, right? It's non-traditional, but it is a way to get people started on their path to recovery. And recovery not just meaning substance use recovery, but recovery to live the best life that they desire.
And oftentimes, those are the people, I think that's a lot of the pushback. People are like, well, they don't know what I've been through.
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
And they feel like they're talking to people that may not have the same experience. So a program like that is helpful because now there's not really an excuse because you have someone's like, look, I've been there.
Yeah.
You know, I know what you're going through. So, you know, we don't have that kind of, that additional stigma there of just sitting there and be like, you can't relate to us.
Yeah.
So Sankofa invites us to look backward and move forward. And so we're going to connect this a little bit to mental health.
Okay.
So what ancestral cultural practices have always kind of supported, do you think, the Black community? I think of one of like storytelling or, you know, kind of these community spaces. But what do you think that we've kind of always done as Black folks that live in a mental health space that we may have not recognized?
You know, I'm a church kid. So I think about some of those old school foundational things from church, and not just like the act of going to church, but being together in community and church and, you know, breaking bread together after church, or the act of clapping your hands and stomping your feet or moving your body, or even just the surrender and silence mm-hmm. and prayer. I think those are definitely some foundational to Black Americans.
Yeah. I mean, you see some people testify in front of hundreds of people.
Yes.
He's like, I just need you to talk to one.
That's right.
And so we've always had those practices, and I think it's helpful to understand that when we come into these spaces, you know, it may look a different way, but the foundation of it has really been something that we've always kind of done
Absolutely.
In our communities. So how does the Sankofa Conference create a space for both truth telling and healing? Because this is one of the first time I think I've seen, you know, our community come together and have different Black folks from very different perspectives come together in one day.
You know, I think truth-telling with different perspectives allows us to hear each other, to hear different lived experiences, and the healing begins when we start to take action. And so it's my hope that from the conference that we'll be able to walk away with some real good takeaways that people can live out in their everyday lives, everyday practice.
For sure. A lot of times, you know, we have this idea of remembering. And sometimes we tend to remember the bad parts of things or the trauma of things. What are some of the things that you're finding in your work that we can see the wellness in ourselves?
In terms of the practices, mm-hmm. is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny enough, I think a lot about your series that you did with Black Joy.
Yeah.
And so when I go into programs and it's our Black kids and they're doing, you know, they're painting or they're dancing or writing a song, and to kind of see the joy, I'm just reminded of the joy that is ours, our rights, that is in us, and that we certainly have access to. And so I hope that we can remember the joy that we have access to, whatever that looks like.
Yes, because so often it's the opposite way. We focus a lot on trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we don't have to, you know, acknowledge and see that it exists, and we know that it exists, but sometimes there is something that's just like, okay, this might be a little too much. We also have to acknowledge our joy in that. And that is, I think, what wellness is for us. Because a lot of times we talk about mental health, but it's always in the negative.
Yeah.
It's always like a deficit.
Yes.
Which is not always the same in other communities. You can go to other communities and they're like, I'm on my meds today. I didn't take my Xanax.
They talk about it very openly, right?
They're very open about it. And so I think we're getting to a point where we can kind of start to see that a little bit in the joys that we have in our daily life. So you're a part of a larger panel on mental health and and health in the Black community. What do you hope this panel helps with people that come to engage?
I can't stress enough that I hope that it starts to chip away at some of the shame. And I hope that it gives folks space and permission to be honest and share, to be vulnerable about the struggles that they have, because you can't heal what you don't acknowledge. And so it's my hope that it will enlighten something in somebody to be okay with not being okay.
Absolutely. What do you want participants to leave ready to do differently in their families or in their communities?
I want folks to be able to start to have the conversation. One of the things you asked about that we're doing, we offer mental health first aid training. We offer that for free to folks in the community. And so it will, and what that does, it prepares folks to be able to really identify, just like physical first aid, mental health first aid, to identify when someone is not well and how to help them or how to help get them the help they need. And so it's my hope that folks will be able to just start to have those conversations and to seek out resources to be able to support those right in their immediate circles, the lives that they touch every day.
Because it's important to who sometimes, because, you know, I feel like now, since it's kind of been a more robust conversation, everyone thinks that they're a clinician.
Right.
And diagnosed, like,
especially on the social media.
Social media. Everybody's a narcissist, right? Like, this.
Everybody is a narcissist. Everybody's talking about the triggers and all the things.
How do you think that we could kind of shift from what is becoming, you know, you while you want mental health to trend to get the help that folks need, you also don't want it to trend in a bad way.
Right.
So what are you kind of seeing some ways that we could, you know, start to change that language? Because everyone can go into their, was it DSM-5?
Right, right. You know, I struggle with that because I'm very happy that we're having these conversations in the social media world, because it does help, it contributes to reducing the stigma and shame regarding mental health. I need folks to be responsible in their conversations online. That's really important. And then hopefully, you know, mental health providers, we have a ton of Black mental health clinicians in the space, that we can show up in these spaces and, you know, speak the truth and give people accurate information.
Yeah, because right now
it's a little shaky. It's a little shaky.
So recently there's been a big push on people talking to AI.
Yes.
As they're, you know, kind of clinicians, and they're just not wanting to talk to people or go out into the space, which is, you know, that could be a certain thing of not wanting to go outside. That can look like depression and all these other things. Mm-hmm. What are some things that you are seeing in the community of getting folks out there to actually engage and go to a best self behavioral health to get that help they need instead of staying inside their homes?
You know, I think, you know, I referenced the peer recovery specialists or peer advocates rather. And I think having somebody to give you that initial push who has gone through it to let you know that it's okay. I don't think there's, you know, you shouldn't use AI for counselors. I think there's your useful AI tools to help people process, but those should just be in addition to. I think it's important for healthcare organizations to kind of learn how to align with these tools that people are accessing to give a little bit of guidance.
Because they're going
to
use them, right?
Like, use them.
We can't avoid people are going to use AI.
They're going to use AI. I will hope that folks are not getting advice or mental health advice from ChatGPT, because ChatGPT is really, it messes up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, just in the everyday things that you ask it to do. But it's my hope that, you know, we can really tap into people's lived experience. I'm going to trust somebody who's been through it and will tell me that counselor XYZ is safe. Also, I think it's really important that we get behind supporting Black clinicians as well. As I mentioned, Best Self has the Black Mental Health Response Team for that reason. We know that folks respond to folks who look like them. And so it's really important to help get people in the door by offering them a safe space by somebody who can recognize their cultural background and upbringing, faith, beliefs, et cetera.
And even going to a place where you know there's Black clinicians are huge. That's very minimal to find around the country, period.
Sure.
Not even just here locally.
Sure.
To find a Black clinician is not easy
at all
to do.
That's one of the conversations that I've been having with some government officials at the state level about how do we eliminate barriers for entry into the field. We have to start to kind of make policy that we make the industry itself accessible for people for career pathways. Mm-hmm. Because the more red tape we put up, more barriers we put up, we will see less and less Black and brown folks becoming clinicians, which we need more than ever.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that was something that, you know, we talked about with one of the other panelists that are also going to be in Sankofa, is like this pipeline, like how do we get more people? And we're so often talking about the patients and the client part of it in the communities, but we actually don't talk about the people that, how do we get them in to serve? How do we get people that are passionate about this work to actually say, hey, here's this program we want you to go in.
Yeah.
It's at, you know, this college or this university, or, you know, we are offering this so that you can be mm-hmm. able to get your certification so that you can work with our people. And it doesn't necessarily always have to be a doctor, right? There's multiple ways that help people in the mental health space and being able to find that pipeline and help people understand that they can get into that work, because mental health is actually one of the top careers for people to get into now that is like, you know, AI will probably never be able to take away.
And it is really important, but there are so many barriers in terms of just the certification process with mm-hmm. people needing to go to school and do internship hours also while working to feed families, et cetera. And so we need to legislatively take those barriers away for underrepresented groups, especially.
Right, because people have full-time jobs and they need to pay for school. They got to get through it. And having those non-traditional pathways is really important.
100%.
If you could shift one thing about how Black communities talk about mental health, what would it be?
How we talk about it. I think just some of the language we use. Language definitely matters. You know, calling people crazy or whatever the term is of the day. We just really have to be mindful about language. I think that's really important. I think we still very much, in many respects, you know, I mentioned being a church kid. I think in many respects, some folks still feel like they can just pray things all away. Mm-hmm. I think we pray and go to therapy.
Pray and action. We do both together.
And so, you know, I think there still is just very much the stigma that we need to work through with language and how we view our approach to treating mental health.
Absolutely. When you imagine a future of Black mental health, what does a healthier world look like?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think the future of Black mental health means we feel safe in our bodies every day, in any context, in any environment. Not just safe with each other, but safe wherever we are. I think it means we have access to our own joy. And I think we are able to clearly articulate who we are and what we stand for without apology.
Absolutely. I love that. What role do you see Best Self playing in that future?
I'm really excited about the work that we are doing with the Black Mental Health Response Team. Because our grant right now focused specifically on Black youth on the east side of Buffalo, and also the work that we are doing with the kids at BBF, we're starting with earlier generations, and they're gonna shape the future of Black wellness. And so we get to give them language and approaches, and so that excites me the most.
Yes. What are you most hopeful for that you're seeing? That may not be the future, but you can see kind of coming soon.
I am most hopeful for this, like, because as you said, I've been in the game for a long time, so
you see all the downs,
the ups and downs, and I see like the new workforce, especially in the team that I supervise on our after school program, these like fresh out of school, energetic folks. And so I'm really excited for what they will bring with their experiences and information and their perspective. I feel like we're on the right track. We did not talk about mental well-being, especially as kids, and feelings like that wasn't a thing.
Right. It was just like, get up, get your stuff together.
Yeah.
And let's go. Like,
you do it because I said so. Right. And I'm gonna give you something to cry about. Stop crying, you know. And so I'm excited that we have these young professionals who are teaching our babies social emotional learning, and our kids get to have language around mental well-being and emotions. And that gives me hope.
Yes, I love that. And we all need it right now, especially mm-hmm. with the younger generation. Mm-hmm. So we're going to end this conversation. I have a question that I've been asking a lot of folks, particularly as it pertains to this conference. The theme of the conference is Know Thyself, a call to the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
Ooh, to the diaspora as a whole, I think it kind of goes back to your question that you said earlier about mental well-being. In order for us to be well, we really have to know ourselves, knowing our history, mm-hmm. Knowing where we are in this present moment, knowing our individual gifts, knowing the things that bring us joy. It is so important for us to truly be able to know ourselves and stand in that before we can be truly mentally well and free.
Absolutely. Know thyself before you trying to tell everybody else what they got
That's
going on.
The part. Right? That's the part. We can figure it out together, but I can't tell you.
Exactly. Chantel, thank you so much for your leadership and your honesty and commitment to our community's well-being. The Sankofa Conference, first annual conference, will be February 28th. It will be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Buffalo Academy for Visual and Performing Arts.
Yes.
And Sankofa reminds us that healing is both ancestral and moving forward, which we talked about today.
So excited.
For more information about Best Self and Behavioral Health, you can...
Yes, they can visit us at bestselfwny.org. We are on all the socials. You can reach out to anyone on the social media and we will get right back to you.
Awesome. And please make sure everyone checks out the Sankofa Conference. I'm super excited.
Yes.
I will be there. I'm bringing my students there as well. So I'll be participating in the different conversations. I'm Naila Ansari Katilla, and this is What's Next. Until next time, go back, gather what you need, and come back strong and bold for the future ahead.
We'll be back with more on What's Next after this on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Public media keeps our community talking and thinking together. Hear perspectives that matter on BTPM NPR. Experience meaningful stories on BTPM PBS. Enjoy performances that connect us on BTPM Classical and discover new voices on BTPM The Bridge. These are conversations that shape our region and open our world. This is public media. Visit btpm.org.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'm Jay Moran. Today, we're going to continue our conversations with some of the individuals who are contributing to the upcoming Sankofa Conference here in the city of Buffalo coming up on February 28th. With us from Mississauga right now, we're talking with Kenya Baker. Hi, Kenya.
Hey, good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us for sure. Kenya, first of all, just talk to me about how you came to be involved with the Sankofa Conference.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm a huge fan. And it's really interesting how I came to be in this conference. So Emmanuel and I are connected on LinkedIn. And, you know, I think Emmanuel was reaching out to folks in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area in Southern Ontario, to sort of see, you know, hey, there's this conference happening, you know, would you be interested in participating and sharing the word? We really want to connect with folks from the Southern Ontario area to be a part of this greater collective. And I was immediately sold. And you know what, though? I actually had already registered for this conference as an attendee, because we're always looking for opportunities where we can grow in our little, you know, cohort of Black folks in Southern Ontario. And when this came up, couple months ago, actually, we signed up for it. So trying to connect the dots, like, oh my goodness, we actually did sign up for this conference. And now I'm coming as a panelist was like really meant to be. So super excited about that.
That's really something that you saw in advance like that. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to this. What were your expectations or hopes for being involved in this initially? Like you said, nobody had reached out to you necessarily. You found it through social media or online or whatever. So what attracted you and what would you hope from a conference like this?
Honestly, just community, right? So some of my core values are community, empathy, and just connecting to folks. And so that was one of the things that I thought it would be really nice to get into community with folks from the US, close enough, but far enough. Like, funny enough, it's quicker to go to Buffalo for me when there's no traffic than it would be to go to downtown Toronto. So it's that close, but yet it seems so far because we have a border, right? And so one of my hopes and goals would be that I would get to connect with people, share some experiences, and really just to build in that whole spirit of Ubuntu. Ubuntu means I am because we are, you are. And so when I go to these conferences and networking spaces, especially for people who look like me, it feels really good to be in a room where people have similar or different values and experiences, but all come together for the common good. So I was just really excited to be going out there and connecting with people. And I'm even more excited now to be able to lend a voice as a panelist.
You most certainly bring a unique experience to this panel. Being someone born in Kenya, mm-hmm. and if I'm not mistaken, also worked in refugee camps mm-hmm. in Africa as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your refugee camp experience. I've met through this program more people than I've ever thought I would who spent time in refugee camps. And sometimes mm-hmm. that time is extensive. Mm-hmm. What did you see? What kind of experience can you share for us to help us better understand that experience?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. You know, when I think about my time working in the refugee world, and I must say I had a privileged experience in terms of the positionality and the power that I carried working in those situations. At the time, I worked for UNHCR, and I've also worked for another entity that supports the immigration of refugees into the US. So I'm literally watching my former colleagues in real time right now, witnessing what's happening in the refugee situation with the United States, because that was a program that I worked for, that was by the Department of Homeland Security. And so when I worked with refugees, I saw pain, but I also saw happiness. It's such an oxymoron because I remember very, very well, I was in Ethiopia for a bit and I worked in a small refugee camp that was on the border of Eritrea and Ethiopia. And I was working with unaccompanied minors. So these are kids who crossed over to the border and they did not come with any parents or guardians over the age of 18. And so they had a special program called the Unaccompanied Minors Program. And my role was to try and help identify foster homes for them and people that would take care of them within the community. And even though some people were not related to these kids, because of the community spirit that existed in the refugee camps, there was an abundance of support that we found for the children. An abundance for support for the kids, but yet there was deficit in terms of the resources the families had. And to me, that was such a beautiful display of togetherness in our communities of color and our Black communities, African communities, that superseded the idea that happiness is attached to resources and finances. So I saw that part in terms of the beauty of it. I also saw the pain, Jay. I saw families that were in real time dealing with loss and genocide and pain and questions and wondering when is my breakthrough ever going to happen? And then I felt helpless in that space too. And so, you know, there was a little bit of a balance, and there was moments when I look back even now and think about some of the deepest experiences I've had. And it takes me back to those days when I used to work out there in the camps. To see what's happening unfold in the world right now really breaks my heart, because that was, that small program was one hope, one ray of hope that a lot of refugees had, that they would have a second chance in their lives. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What do you make of the current, I guess, political atmosphere that has shut out so many people from this opportunity? Do you feel like do you ever find yourself in debates over that issue? I'm just wondering, and how you counter somebody who's saying, no, you know, I mean, well, we hear it. I mean, I don't have to name names, but we most certainly hear people trying to push back against migration and how it, you know, well, I'll have to step off. I'm walking into a place I don't want to be. I'll leave it to you.
I want you to have your job too at NPR, PBS. you know what, Jay? I think I try not to get into debates because we don't debate human rights. Human rights are not debatable. But I do let people know that I've seen the benefit of immigration on, even in Canada. And I also remind people that unless you're Indigenous, First Nations, Inuit, Métis, you are an immigrant as well. And so if you can connect to that, then you can definitely connect to the current situation that's happening in the world. I think about, it's so interesting, Jay. So I'm now in Ontario, but I used to live in Calgary, Alberta. And I lived there for about a decade before I moved out here to Ontario. And before I moved here, I was at a hair salon getting my hair done. And there was a lady who kept looking over, and I could see she was trying to make contact with me, but she wasn't quite sure. And then she walked up to me, and she got the courage and walked up to me and said, "Hi, are you Kenya?" And I said, "Yes." And I could tell she was Ethiopian just by looking at her. You know, East Africans, we all can figure out where someone's from. And she says, "I don't know if you remember me, but my name is blank. And you and I met when I was a refugee in Kenya years ago. And I just wanted to say that when you supported me," because I was her social worker there, "when you supported me, you gave me a chance. And then I know you moved on, because I then went on another assignment somewhere else. But the help that you provided through the program that you had gave me a chance in life," because she was actually quite suicidal at the time because of this refugee experience. And she experienced a lot of violence and harm in her immigration story. So fast forward to now, she is living in Alberta. She has her business. She is flourishing. She has a family, her mental health. I could not recognize her because she looked so healthy and whole. And I could just see how her having this chance changed her life. And she is forever grateful for being given a chance, because now as a business owner in Alberta, she's employing other people. She's contributing to the economy. And I don't like equating or justifying these types of things based on capitalism. But I can most certainly see that her human rights have been honored in her being put in a situation where she can thrive. And I think about people like her and so many others who have this story and say, why can't we all share the pie? Why can't we all share the pie, you know? So when people start debating, you know, is it right? Is it what? I'm like, you need to see some of the conditions. A lot of folks would love to be back in their home countries, but it is not possible for them right now, period.
Well, that's quite a story, Kenya. I can only imagine how moving that was to come across that, that woman, for sure. You're... A business is called Shades of Humanity Consulting. Mm-hmm. Give us some background into that.
Yeah. So I'll give you a bit of my, I'm a storyteller, Jay. So stop me when you need to, but.
I never stop a good storyteller, Kenya.
So here's the thing. I grew up in Kenya and most of the people around me looked like me. So when we think about the experiences of racism and discrimination, when people immigrate to a country, they start to experience that firsthand and in real time, versus somebody who was born here or is generationally from the diaspora and has been here for years and years. You sort of get this resilience when you're born here versus when you immigrate here, you build that resilience. Okay. So I moved here, you know, not really having a deeper knowledge or understanding or experience of racism. And I take that as a privilege. I speak out of privilege when I say that. And then finally catching up, because when I did some research, it takes about 3 years for someone to actually now go through that full cycle to catch up on what racism and that experience feels like as an immigrant. And I started to realize these "where are you from" questions are not people who are genuinely curious about me. They are literally saying, "You are not from here and you do not belong." And it is a microaggression. And I said, what can I do instead of complaining? What can I do to create a space where people can actually sit with empathy and people can actually use genuine curiosity, not weaponized curiosity, to have conversations about your origin story? And so I said, at the end of it all, we're humans, right? And we have different shades of our humanity. Nothing's black or white, pun, right? And so it could be your gender identity. It could be your cultural identity. These are all different shades of humanity. And my goal and my role is to create a space where we can have not just conversations, but learning and challenge ourselves in some of the beliefs that we hold about humanity. So my platform right now, I'm working with folks in the sports world, in academia, in the healthcare field, you know, just really getting people to have these conversations, not just on a performative basis, Jay, but like really deeply to connect us to humanity, which is very much like the whole idea of Sankofa, which is go back and fetch, right? Mm. And so I'm really hoping that folks can go back and fetch. And so I found healing for Shades of Humanity. I feel like I did it to get my own healing and then created a space where people can have their own healing as well.
We'll continue with our conversation on what's next after a short break.
Public media starts here, in our neighborhoods, our schools, our city halls, where decisions meet real life. BTPM NPR's local reporters are asking the questions that matter, listening to the people affected, and explaining what it all means for our region.
There's a lot of poor record keeping. There are records that lists that don't reconcile with other lists. There's a lot of gasoline that's being used that isn't properly accounted for. And there are a lot of people with take-home vehicles.
That's Erie County Comptroller Kevin Hardwick. He's outlining just a few of the issues his office found when conducting an audit of the county's vehicle fleet.
From paper trails to public impact, this is journalism that stays with the story and with the community it serves. Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR produces journalism with depth, care, and purpose. This is Public Media.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at the Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Our guest today on What's Next is Kenya Baker. Kenya is going to be one of the panelists coming up at the Sankofa Conference on February 28th here in Buffalo. I'm glad you brought that up because you kind of outlined one of the things I found in your bio and about Shades of Humanity Consulting is that you help people learn to have difficult but life-changing conversations. Mm-hmm. And to hear you talk as you're just right now, I'm wondering if there's some advice you can give, free advice, I guess we're asking from a professional consultant, but you know, especially here in the United States, I can't speak for Canada, is a real polarization. And we hear this, oh, we have to have conversation. We have to have these conversations. Yet, and I can speak from my personal experience, not really all that interested in having conversations with people on who are support a certain stance in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you have advice for someone like me or anybody like that who sees that, you know, I have something to express about who I am, what I see, what I want, and I don't agree with you, but I still want to have that conversation. How can you lead us toward that a little bit?
That's a tricky one, right? And that's why I always try and center that whole idea of empathy. But my empathy ends when your boundaries crossed, when you've crossed my boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like there has to be some sort of we're gauging. We have a meter as to when we're going to have these conversations. And if we're debating, it's not happening. It's really important that, and I always take a trauma-informed approach to having conversations and recognizing that sometimes when people want to poke the bear, they're not being very trauma-informed to my experiences. And I'll give a very clear example where I was explaining something that happened to me to someone, a white person, and they said, but how are you, why do you think that was racist? Why do you think that was racism? Right? Literally, I was being followed in a store, Jay, in a store, as I was shopping, and every step I take, right? And so I'm here explaining this to this person, and this person is like, maybe the security guard was just doing their job. I said, if they were just doing their job, then literally everyone should have a security guard following them, okay? And so I tell people that empathy means it doesn't have to happen to you for it to matter. And so if it's happening to me and it's not happening to you, it doesn't mean that it doesn't matter. And that is the stance I take when having these types of conversations, Jay. Now, if somebody wants to keep challenging it, I draw my boundary and I say, I'm sorry, but we can't really continue to have this conversation. This whole agree to disagree thing is not my philosophy.
Okay. You know, it is interesting to hear you say that. So I guess maybe what we're saying here is that, like you said, there are just certain places maybe we can't go to certain types of conversations if a certain stance is held.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also have to feel safe to be able to have conversations like that. And that's what we're seeing online now, right? So many attacks on people. There's no safety. We're debating things that shouldn't be debated. And no. Yeah. So I think safety is also really important. And that's why I say trauma-informed. And one of the elements and principles of being trauma-informed is there has to be an element of safety in conversation.
Before we went on the air, you shared a story about your three-year-old and a conversation you just had.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating conversation that puts you in a place that probably, I'm wondering how it felt when your three-year-old began asking you questions about her skin color, your skin color.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through that, if you don't mind sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, I am Kenyan-Canadian. I am married to a white Canadian of European origin. And my daughter is a beautiful mix of being an African-Canadian girl. And she's, from a young age, she started to notice differences. You know, her skin's fair. It's not like mom's, but it's also not like dad's. And yesterday, now she asked me once again, basically asking me how she should identify. She noticed that I'm darker skin and her dad is very fair and she's somewhere in between. The one thing that we are doing, and this is really part of the Sankofa going back and fetching, is I am teaching my daughter to be bilingual or multilingual as I am. As well, so that her identity will start to evolve beyond just her skin color and how she identifies physically, but also what she is rooted and grounded in. And we have chosen very intentionally because we know this world is not going to see her as a white girl, that she, if she is rooted and anchored in culture and something, her identity will be strong and she'll be proud of who she is. And so away from just talking about skin color, she's going to understand that she is this beautiful mix of cultures, but even more so, she's going to be centered in that culture. And that's really how I'm encouraging parents who come to my consulting firm to talk about, what do I do? My kids were born here. There's a struggle, right? You've probably spoken to folks who are part of the diaspora, and you're not fully one culture, you're not fully the other culture, you're a host or you're a guest. Like, there's just so many nuances. And really, the idea of going back to fetch is about being grounded. And so that is sort of like, I'm hoping, the philosophy that I am going to continue taking with my daughter.
You live in Ontario now. Like you said, you lived in Alberta before that as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you're familiar with the United States right now and a lot mm-hmm. of the conversations and attitudes that are existing here. Do you find Canada different, better, worse? How do you find it?
Oh, that is such an interesting question. I can't have my citizenship revoked, so I can talk.
But... Very good. I don't think mine can be. I hope not.
Here's the thing, Jay. The thing, and I think a lot of Canadians will tell you this, it's racism, discrimination, those attitudes here are polite. And it's a little confusing when you have polite racism, when you have overt racism that's in your face. You are not welcome here. You will know not to go to that space. But when it's covered in niceness, you know, Canadians, we have a really nice reputation. They're great people. Great people.
Absolutely.
however, it's hard to tell when microaggressions are happening because they're very subtle. And so a racialized person will tell you that might actually be a bit more harmful, because you never fully know. It's never fully indicated to you that you are not welcome here. And I see how our Indigenous communities here continue to fight for equity. Actually, we cannot have a conversation on equity without mentioning equity and the fight for Indigenous rights. And so there's a lot of pain that people are slowly beginning to grapple with and deal with. But I will say this, we are learning from what's happening in America, and we're doing our very best to not get to that place. But that's not to say that we're not struggling with the same issues here, and that they're not spilling over as well. Because there is a bit of a resurgence of extremists that are coming up, that are aligning with some of the polarized views that are happening to our neighbors in the South. And so I'm happy to also say that there's strength in numbers in terms of people who are trying to fight it and combat it. And that's even through our leadership. So I think we're in an okay-ish place, but we're not there yet. There's stuff happening, and you will hear about it. Yeah.
And we're coming down to our final moments here. So we have a final question. The theme of the Sankofa conference is Know Thyself. Mm-hmm. Call the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
Oh, you know, I love that question so much. I actually wrote down a reflection, Jay. Oh. I'm a little bit of a nerd.
Oh, hey, we love nerds here at BTPM NPR. We're all nerds.
Okay, so I think when we think about Sankofa, you know, the whole go back and fetch philosophy, it's something that I thought about deeply in my growth and in my recovery and my trying to really understand historically that I also was not taught the correct information growing up. I grew up in Africa, but I did not get the right history because even our education was colonized. So for me, know thyself means returning to yourself on three levels. It is personal, historical, and collective. So personally, it's the inner work of remembering who I am beyond what society projects onto Blackness, beyond productivity, struggle, and stereotype. And then historically, it's reclaiming the truth that Africa is not a footnote, it is foundational. So when our history is taught incompletely, we inherit the incomplete sense of self. And then collectively, the call to the diaspora is a call into relationship. It is a call across differences within Black communities, because that exists. And so we can build solidarity that's honest and that is not performative. And then for me in Canada, it looks like connecting historical truth to my present day reality in our workplaces, in our schools, in our systems, and then translating that into action that reduces harm and that restores dignity. For me, that is what knowing thyself means, Jay.
Wow. That's quite the answer. And I really appreciate your honest answers here throughout our conversation, for your time being with us today on What's Next, and also the fact that you're going to be coming to Buffalo to be at the Sankofa conference coming up on February 28th. Yeah. Jenny Baker, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Are you coming to the conference?
I hope to be coming to the conference. We'll leave it okay. Right there. Yeah, I don't like to make promises I can't keep or don't keep, but that's where I stand right now.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I hope that you will be there, or at least you'll catch snippets of it if you're not available.
Well, if you're going to be there, it's another reason to go. Kenya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jay.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.